Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. This month, four astronauts arrived at the International Space Station thanks to the SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket that launched from the Kennedy Space Center in Florida. It was a milestone for both NASA and SpaceX as the Crew Dragon's first fully operational mission, and it marks its second crewed flight. The government and private agencies have been working together for about a decade to get more people into space. This recent accomplishment also makes us think about what's in store for the future of private space travel for the ISS and beyond. Astronomy contributor Jean Creighton joins me now, and she notes that while the SpaceX may seem shiny and new, it's just the latest in private companies working with the government.
It's true that people imagine that this is a brand new thing and maybe a departure from what NASA used to do. But perhaps it's useful to remind our audience that the Apollo missions required NASA to subcontract with 20,000 companies in order to make all the various parts that they required. And I guess one of the, I was reading around the 50th anniversary that perhaps the single most magnificent achievement of NASA was to coordinate that effort, to give companies the exact specifications of what they required, help them do the quality control inspection, and integrate all those different parts into a moving spacecraft. So this is definitely a continuation of a tradition that's been established for 60 years now, if not 70.
So why are private companies even interested in this? Are they often working on something that can be easily adapted to serve NASA's purposes? Or are they starting with the idea of space innovation and engineering in mind?
I think there's a little bit of both. Many of these companies treat NASA as a client, and NASA as a space agency has pretty deep pockets. So it makes sense to provide products that NASA can use. However, there's also this issue of clearly private companies are more interested in space travel now, and that's because a confluence of events has taken place that makes, at least potentially, space travel cheaper. So, for example, a big thing now is to be able to reuse in materials. So because it used to be you would launch, so you burn a tremendous amount of fuel, and as those stages, those pieces of the rocket that carry the fuel, they empty. Well, you don't carry dead weight with you, you drop it. And those pieces would fall into the ocean, they disintegrate, you know, whatever, but you can't recover them. And, you know, that was what we accepted had to be. However, now we've developed materials, composite materials, so not sheets of aluminum, that you can reuse because we have smart enough computers that you can tell, okay, you piece that are coming down, I want you to actually fall right here. So they can figure out, you've seen some of these landings, the pieces come back on a platform as if you ran the movie backward. It really is quite impressive. And the first time I saw that, I thought, oh, come on. How could it possibly be so precise? What we need to remember is that the Apollo missions were running on computers that are significantly, like, millions of times less powerful than the computer on your phone right now. Imagine if we really put a serious computer behind this, we can really do calculations and make things happen that simply weren't possible or even imaginable in the 60s. So on the one hand, we have the technology to rescue some of the pieces, which is great. The other thing is that we now can make materials that are much easier to manufacture. You can make huge pieces. They don't require the same amount of labor. So labor is one of the really expensive pieces of this, and you can eliminate a lot of it, which means in the end that you have launches that you can change the cost by an order of magnitude. And then it becomes almost, if you're rich enough, I mean, maybe you and I, Audrey, aren't going to go to the International Space Station, but if you have a couple hundred thousand dollars burning a hole in your pocket, it's possible to do that, to spend a few, you know, a few minutes in weightlessness, or if you spend a little more, you could, in fact, get to the International Space Station under certain circumstances. So it's interesting to watch how this progression has taken place and how it's possible that it will continue in the future. Now, I don't think that deep space is going to be taken up by private companies.
Right. Do you think that, you know, you mentioned NASA has the big pockets. They've established a lot of the groundwork, so to speak, that has needed to be done in order to get to where we are today. And while deep space compared to low Earth orbit, those are two very different things. So do you think the privatization will remain in the low Earth orbit for the foreseeable future?
That would be my guess, because I think deep space not only requires know-how, you have to have thousands of scientists and engineers who are going to analyze the data that you collect, who are going to plan missions. This is not a, you know, a small budget operation. Oh, we'll have this little R&D little group of people, you know, half a dozen people do this. You really need a much larger, I want to say the word army, a much larger group of people who can stand behind you. So for now, I imagine that this is definitely going to still be on, you know, on space agencies around the world. What I do imagine is that these things become more collaborative. That I can certainly see.
At one time, we thought a lot of this was the stuff of science fiction, but do you foresee things like private space stations in our future or a base on the moon?
Well, that's the plan, right? The plan is to get a base on the moon and a space station, if you will, around the moon. We'll see how this all is impacted by COVID. But if we want to get somebody to the moon, which is we're supposed to be wanting to do that in 2024. The goal is to get a human and the first woman on the moon by 2024. That's going to require, if we're going to do that for any period of time, for any length of time, it's going to be a lot easier to launch back and forth to the moon if we had a base around the moon. Now, this already starts a little, sounds a little bit like science fiction, but that's the plan. And if we have such a scheme established, then it's going to be a whole lot easier again to go to Mars, which is the hope for 2040. Now, every time an administration changes, things could change, priorities and such. So we'll have to see. But I know for a fact that, for example, a return mission to Mars is already being planned as we speak. It's already moving. That's scheduled for 2030. So we just have to wait and see. But all these partnerships, these successful missions, you know, build confidence that the current partnerships that NASA has with private companies might be as fruitful as prior ones.
So these two sectors can really complement each other, and it's not necessarily, you know, is there a wide misconception of privatization of space turns into, you know, letting development go unchecked, so to speak, but in space?
Well, it could. I mean, the fact of the matter is that private companies are sending hundreds of satellites that are very small, but they are disruptive to astronomers. And apparently nobody really thought about that as a problem. Now they're trying to, after the fact, they're trying to figure out how to minimize the effect so that it's not as detrimental. But it does remind us that really oversight is is helpful. And people should be talking and figuring out how does what I do impact other parts of society.
So although the SpaceX launch, it was funded by government funds, but it's a big step forward. It's a big change. So what do you think is the next trial for private either jobs similar to SpaceX up to ISS or other contracts that are in the works?
I think the next best batch of, or the next sort of future batch of things is surrounding what I already described, that whole idea of getting people back to the moon and whether we're going to build a base, because that's the idea. It's called Gateway, a base around that. I assume that parts of that will be built by contractors, subcontractors for NASA. Any of that that can come together in a way that's innovative, opportunities to show, to showcase some new technology, some new material, all of those things would be great for everyone involved.
When it comes to establishing a moon base, having more low orbit and deep space missions, what are, I mean, we're beyond international regulations because we're not even on Earth, but yeah, who gets to call dibs or establish the first base on the moon and say it's NASA's base versus international partners? Is there any diplomacy already established in how we move forward in new things, not just for NASA in the United States, but international space exploration?
There are treaties and rules. You're right, of course, that when you change the game, you have to make sure that, you know, these are revisited and people agree. One of the difficulties with having governments that aren't always talking very nicely to each other is that these conversations sometimes get unfruitful, let's put them that way. but I think there certainly are some regulations in place that you can't just go around saying this is mine or what have you. But that's another issue with private companies, that they haven't signed such treaties. So I think these are good conversations. It's good to have people aware of policy that should be in place, that should be abided by everyone involved.
Well, very exciting steps for everyone, and we'll continue to see what develops in our future.
We sure will. And as always, I very much appreciate chatting with you, Audrey.
Lake Effect contributor Jean Creighton is the director of the Manfred Olson Planetarium on the UW-Milwaukee campus. You can explore all of our astronomy segments with her at wuwm.com.